Over the last few decades, the landscape and daily operations of the American farm have changed dramatically with technology, crop prices, crop technique, and farm size. One thing that has stayed the same is the individual farmers who are adapting to these techniques. I'm Suzanne Hogan. This is Central Standard on KCUR. Today, we look at the aging farmer and what this means for the future of agriculture. For each farmer younger than 25 years old, there are five who are 75 or older, which means retirement in the farming community is being prolonged. Plus, a conversation with writer Peter Vonsegeiser about his new memoir, The Looking Glass Brother, a story about family dysfunction, love and loyalty, and mental illness. Stay with us for Central Standard just after this hour's news. Peter Vonsegeiser was expecting his firstborn. He had moved from Kansas City, where he had been covering the arts, to Greenwich Village. He was working in New York as a writer, filmmaker, multimedia artist, when he received a telephone call from the other Peter Vonsegeiser, also known as Little Peter, his stepbrother, whom he hadn't heard from for years. Good morning, this is Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Suzanne Hogan. In his youth, Little Peter had attended elite schools and was a violin prodigy. Little Peter had come to adopt Big Peter's last name after his father remarried. They had a privileged childhood, private schools, European vacations. Now as an adult, Little Peter was living on the streets, a schizophrenic known for bouts of violence, erratic behavior. In his new memoir, The Looking Glass Brother, our guest today, Peter Vonsegeiser, or Big Peter, tells the story of his complicated relationship with his stepbrother, who shares the same name. A tale of mental illness, family dysfunction, pain, and love. Later in the hour, the aging American farmer and the looming impact it could have on the future of farming. But first, Peter Vonsegeiser, thank you so much for joining us on Central Standard.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I should also mention that Peter will be reading his memoir at Boulevard Brewing Company this Sunday at 4 o'clock. You can find more information on our website at kcur.org. And this book was highly recommended yesterday on Up to Date from book doctor Steve Paul. So we're excited to be here talking with you. Peter, can you tell us about your stepbrother, Little Peter, and what was your relationship with him like?
Well, I first met my stepbrother when he was about 5 years old, and I was 17. And he was just this beautiful child. You know, he was incredibly smart. He had blonde hair and really startling blue eyes and a photographic memory. He was a violin prodigy and played piano really well. And he was sort of an astonishing kid.
Did you guys start off immediately as friends? Did you connect?
You know, it's funny. I think my sisters and I felt that the life that this next generation of kids, my father's second marriage, was sort of decadent. We were sort of hippies, and our impulse was to rescue him and his brother and sister. We just wanted to save them and maybe take them out into the woods and feed them brown rice and vegetables.
How did the family dynamic change after your father remarried?
Well, my father started a second life and basically just had moved on. And so we were teenagers and we were involved in all kinds of teenagery activities. And so things were a little scattered at that point. But I think that basically what happened was there was Peter just got he grew up and became a teenager himself, and we were kind of grew into adults, and we kept tabs with him. We watched him. We went to piano recitals and violin recitals and things like that. And at a certain point, I began to hear stories about little Peter that he was maybe. He was incredibly smart, so he learned to make keys and kind of get into his school. He was going to the Dalton School. I remember one time he had somehow climbed down the fire escape and broken into the library, and he was into video games and had stolen a little bit of money to play video games. Those little kind of things, they were warning signs.
So there were kind of high hopes for little Peter, him being a violin prodigy, and he started to get into some trouble. But when did you kind of start to notice that maybe something more serious was going on, that there may be mental illness?
Well, it's funny. There was an interesting dynamic between little Peter and me. I mean, I think at the time I met him, I was kind of the wastrel. I was hitchhiking around the country. I was hanging around with the wrong people. I had been kicked out of boarding school and was going to public high school. And everyone had kind of, I think, to some extent, written me off. It looked like I was on the downward trajectory. And little Peter came in, and here was this little Lord Fauntleroy kid, sort of on the upward trajectory. And at a certain point, I think our trajectory started crossing. He was kicked out of a couple of schools, and then he ended up at this school called St. Anne's in Brooklyn, which is a school for geniuses, basically. And they specialized in taking troubled but brilliant kids and getting them into Harvard. Well, little Peter didn't go to Harvard. I think he went to the University of New Hampshire. And at that time, pretty much things had changed quite a bit. And I think he lasted just 2 or 3 months. And at that point, I remember one incident. He was supposed to come home for Thanksgiving. My father sent him money, and he went to Logan Airport in Boston. And he never left Logan Airport. He was there for the entire Thanksgiving break, just wandering around the airport and enjoying it. Sort of. That was his first, I think, brush with homelessness. And one time he told me, you know, that was a really great time. I felt free. I felt as though I didn't have to worry about school or anything else. And I think eventually he moved completely into that world.
And you started to hear things about your brother, that he, stepbrother, that he was starting to act out and get into trouble and make some enemies. Can you give us some examples of things that he was getting involved in?
Oh, you know, I think it was very hard to tell what he was doing from normal teenage activities at first. It wasn't until he started traveling around the country as after college that he really sort of started getting into some serious trouble. But one thing about my stepbrother is he never really did anything malicious or mean. He just liked to party and have a good time. And sometimes he would drink a little too much. And I think the thing that really changed his life and sent him on a trajectory into homelessness was when he was living in Montana, and he was being a musician. He was hanging around with musicians. He got drunk one day, fell asleep in a wheat field, and woke up just as a harvest combine was actually running over him. And he put up his hands to protect himself, and both of his hands were nearly severed at the wrists. And that was a terrible tragedy. I mean, it was just devastating for a musician. He was flown to Salt Lake City, and his hands were reattached. But at that point, I think his mental state, his hallucinations came to the fore. And he, I think from that time on, as a young man, he became a full-time homeless person.
Was he ever diagnosed as being schizophrenic?
I think so, although I've heard several diagnoses here and there. Some people think he might just be Asperger's because he had some of those things. He's a real savant, very super intelligent, photographic memory, that kind of thing.
So we're going to jump to where we started in the introduction, which is the beginning of the book. And it's a really gripping first chapter. You're expecting your firstborn, and you get a call from little Peter, which is the first in a really long period of time that you've heard from him. What were some of the things that were going through your mind when you first heard his voice?
Well, I was fascinated, to tell you the truth. I, you know, living in New York, you see homeless people around you. It's a world that you're completely cut off from, but you can't help from being curious. It's part of your landscape. And when Peter called me up, I thought, oh my gosh, here's a call from the other side of the looking glass. And that's hence the title of the book. I mean, he was in a world that I just knew nothing about. And on the other hand, I thought, oh my God, I got to go get out there and do something. I got to help this kid. So I went out and met him on the street.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Suzanne Hogan. We're talking with writer and multimedia artist Peter Vontageser about his new memoir, The Looking Glass, which we're going to hear an excerpt from now, if you wouldn't mind reading a bit for us.
Oh, sure. Okay. This is from near the beginning of the book, and it describes how I first met him, or I first saw him. His walk was one that stray cats and homeless men develop unconsciously, an ambulatory cringe that says to the world, don't beat me, I'm moving on. I'm just taking this piece of sandwich, this container of mooshu pork, this spit-soaked cigarette butt. You don't want it, now I've got it. I'll stop defiling your view in a minute. The way I knew it was little Peter, finally, was his eyes. His astonishing eyes, still blue and clear as Paul Newman's. His nose had flattened and grown red and pulpy, and there was a huge long scar over his right eye that gave him a permanently worried look. His torn jeans and stained corduroy jacket had become too small for his thick and doughy body. The sleeves of his flannel shirt stuck out beyond his jacket sleeves, and over the flannel shirt was a long, untucked T-shirt. He was growing a beard, and his hair, once blonde, was now orange, mixed with toffee brown, and was molded over his head like a bowl. Before he reached me, he picked a white paper bag from a trash can, pried it open, and rattled the interior. The sound and motion were automatic and mechanical. They reminded me of the movements of a caged fox returning again and again to its pan to check whether any specks of food remained. Peter, I called out through the darkness and the blowing snow. He swung his two plastic bags uncertainly this way and that, as if about to turn and run. With a furtive expression, he walked up to me. Big Peter? Yes, it's me, I said. Carefully, I put my arms around my stepbrother's shoulders and gave him a hug. The hair on his face had bleached in tufts over the rough red skin of his cheeks. He's gone feral, I thought.
That's Peter Vontageser reading from his new memoir, The Looking Glass. I want to talk a little bit about how little Peter lets you into his world after that that meeting on the street.
Well, little Peter would come in and out of New York. He had kind of a giant circuit that he made all over the United States. One of his stops, by the way, was Kansas City. He stopped in Albuquerque and places in Idaho and San Francisco. And he would come back to New York, usually in the dead of winter when it was freezing. He would sleep on a grate within eyesight of the apartment in which he'd grown up on the Upper West Side. I mean, literally, he could see his bedroom window from where he was sleeping. And he would call me, and I would go and meet him. I would put him up in a hotel if he was willing. There happened to be a great old Skid Row hotel near me in the village called the Jane West Hotel, which is where they had taken the Titanic survivors after they were rescued. And they had a lot of little rooms there, and he would stay for a while, but then his paranoia would make him move out. He would think that people were looking into his brain and reading his thoughts, and so he'd end up back in the street. And I'd take my family and we'd go meet him at a restaurant. He liked certain restaurants. He was very good at choosing restaurants. He'd always pick the best and the cheapest ones, so you always knew you were going to eat well when you met Peter. And my kids got to know him growing up as Uncle Peter. My oldest son, Alden, would get would involve him in political arguments, which was kind of funny. I mean, Alden would be about 5 years old, and that was during the war in Iraq, and Alden would say, "Where are the weapons of mass destruction?" And Peter would say, "Hey, you can't question your president like that because my stepbrother was politically conservative." And they'd have these funny little arguments while we ate Chinese food.
While writing The Looking Glass Brother, what did you find that little Peter taught you about stigmas around homelessness and mental illness?
Well, I guess you could say every homeless person has his own story and is a real live person. I find myself much more able to look at a homeless person in New York and know that it's a real person. Know that if I wanted to, I could go and talk to him and he might have something to say to me as well. I think that in this country, it might be possible at some point to devise a social safety net that could include homeless people. I think they have to improve the medicines that they give homeless people. Maybe that, I mean, schizophrenics, I think that's a possibility at some point. But I think I learned to appreciate Peter. You know, he's a different person than we are, and the life that he leads now is the life that he's suited for, and he likes it. It maybe took him a few years to get used to it, but now if you asked him, he'd say, "This is the only life I can lead."
You say schizophrenics live in a world of external violence commensurate with their internal chaos. They assault, are assaulted, and commit suicide with greater frequency than the rest of the population.
I think that is true, and it's a dangerous life out on the street. I mean, not only from other homeless people, but from police. I mean, my stepbrother was almost put away in a penitentiary in Florida for a year and a half for a crime that he didn't commit, and I had to go down and hire a lawyer and get him out. And he would have been injured, I think, in the pen. I mean, jails are dangerous places. Now homeless people almost routinely get sent to jail because we have no other place to put them. On the other hand, I think there's something to be said for sleeping out in the open.
Did you always feel that way when little Peter was first doing this?
Well, when I first met him on the street, I did what anybody would do, is I tried to get him off the street. And I tried various ways, tried to get him in drug rehab programs and things like that. And eventually, I think we just got used to each other. I got used to him, and he got used to me. And he was very upset, I think, when I first met him. He was getting used to homelessness, his accident, rejection by his family. And I think over the years, he became a more settled, balanced person. And I think one thing I've been thinking about is you can be schizophrenic and you can also have problems. And I think that as he's grown older, he's worked through some of those problems. But he still is a person who enjoys being outside. And he is, by the way, an athlete. He can ride a bike from Denver to Idaho, which is 800 miles, foraging along the way. He's an amazing outdoorsman.
Were you at all apprehensive or nervous writing a memoir about something like this so deeply personal to you and how it might be projected by your family or other loved ones?
Well, I'm having to deal with a little bit of family kickback now, but not too badly. And I feel that it was important. I also, as a writer, wanted to write about myself. I've been writing about other people for a long time. I felt that my family was kind of interesting, and I felt, boy, I've been keeping a lot under my hat for a long time, and I'd like to just, you know, get it out there. I've always admired writers like Jack Kerouac and William Burroughs, who were able to put it all out on the page, Allen Ginsberg. And I felt as though this was my opportunity. So it's not just about Peter, it's about me.
And then having the same name, you mentioned that sometimes the two of you would be mistaken for one another.
Oh, yeah. I just got invited to Little Peter's 30th Choate reunion.
Or you had people calling you perhaps upset about certain things that Little Peter had done?
Well, that happened earlier on. One time, Peter was a bicycle messenger in New York, and I got this irate phone call from a guy. Peter was supposed to deliver negatives of a photo shoot of Tommy Tune, and Little Peter hadn't shown up. And I was actually in Kansas City then. So I said, hold on. And I called and got Little Peter's younger brother to round him up and send him back with the negatives.
You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. I'm Suzanne Hogan. We're talking with writer Peter Vonsegaser about his new memoir, The Looking Glass Brother. We've been talking so much about your current work, but you do have strong relationships to Kansas City. You went to the Kansas City Art Institute, used to cover the arts for the Kansas City Star, even KCUR back in the late 80s and early 90s. And even after you moved from Kansas City to New York, you kept a close eye on the Kansas City art scene. Why?
Well, it's kind of Kansas City is kind of where I came to age. I met my wife here, and I had a lot of good years here, and a lot of good friends. I hadn't planned it this way, but if you look at my Facebook page, I would say about 80% of the people on it are from Kansas City. And I wrote a long piece for the Charlotte Street Foundation and their 10-year anniversary, and I got to come back and meet all the young artists and hang out, and it was great to see how much Kansas City had changed and how it had matured and developed and basically blossomed.
Yeah, in what ways has it changed specifically with the Charlotte Street?
Oh, well, I mean, I think they're sort of like a fairy godmother. You know, they Just the idea that artists would be appreciated and understood and valued for what they do, not only by the Charlotte Street Foundation, but by local business people. And you saw this real estate renaissance in downtown Kansas City as well, which is what happens when artists move in, by the way, although I don't think the business community was quite ready for it. I don't think they understood. Just the same has happened in New York and Soho years before. I mean, it's a cultural renaissance, and I think David Hughes had a hand in just saying, "Hey, let's just see things as they really are. This is an incredible resource for Kansas City, and the artists I think have really transformed the city. I think it's great." New restaurants, galleries, just street life.
And as you stay in New York, how are you still connected to the Kansas City scene? I know you say on Facebook you're friends with people, but do you make frequent visits back? And
well, I wouldn't say frequent, but every year or so I come back and hang around. And some of my best friends are here, really, my oldest and best friends. And I love to come. And John McDonald of the Boulevard Brewing Company is one of my oldest friends, and I'm one of the original investors of the brewery, and Kathy Marchant, who started the Bluebird Cafe, is an old friend of mine, and Alan Winkler was my roommate in college at the Art Institute, and I just know so many people here, I can't stay away.
What were some of the most memorable stories that you wrote for the Star during your time here in Kansas City as an arts writer?
Well, I'm not sure if any of them were memorable, to tell you the truth. I did write a kind of a wrap-up for Art in America, and I kind of felt at that time the art scene was kind of going through a sea change. There were the old established galleries whose prime modus was to get New York artists and expensively bring them in. And then there were a bunch of people like John O'Brien who was bringing in artists, local artists, and showing them. And I just thought, and I wrote about that, and I got a lot of flack from the establishment, but I also got a lot of praise from the people who were really doing stuff. So I think that was an important article. I would say that's one of the things I'm the most proud of.
Well, in the 10-year anniversary of the Charlotte Street Foundation piece that you wrote, you kind of lay out this shift that happened from the high art and kind of the avant-garde underground art scene that you were more involved in, and then it seems that it kind of started to merge more and more with the Charlotte Street. Can you talk about that?
I think so. I mean, you could say the main artists, local artists who were appreciated were the faculty of the Kansas City Art Institute. And the students were basically expected to go to Minneapolis or New York and kind of do something there and not hang around. So when the students started staying and often working for, just working in the neighborhood and doing stuff, then I think that's when the scene started really changing. And they knew that maybe they'll get that tap on the shoulder from the Charlotte Street people, and that gave them a little hope.
So you're back in Kansas City. We're about to take a break. You're going to be talking about your new book. What are you most excited about coming back to Kansas City, seeing the sites or certain galleries?
Well, I brought my youngest son, who's 12, Magnus, and my daughter, Maya, and we're going to basically go on a mac and cheese tour of Kansas City. And Magnus is really into gourmet food, so we're going to maybe go to a couple of restaurants, higher-end restaurants. And I'm just excited to hang out and relax and see my friends. I'm excited about the reading at the brewery on Sunday, so it'll be fun. I'm into it.
Well, Peter von Tekeser, thank you so much for joining us and for sharing your story.
It's been a pleasure, Suzanne. Thank you.
Peter will be reading The Looking Glass Brother at Boulevard Brewing Company this Sunday at 4 p.m. You can find out more information on our website at kcur.org. We're going to take a break. When we come back, the aging American farmer and what it means for the future of farming. I'm Suzanne Hogan. This is Central Standard. We'll return in just a moment.